Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 350 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show designed and developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scene and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down the love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. It is the beginning of July, so we turn to the Los Angeles Times Plants newsletter, written by Pedro Mora, published on July 1st in the Los Angeles Times. An editor's note: starting with this edition, the newsletter will be published twice a month, once on the 1st and then on the 15th. Today's newsletter: want to garden and meet other plant people? Join Farm Party. Welcome to July, readers. 10 days ago, I visited a favorite garden to check in on a nascent partnership. I thought you might enjoy reading about it. Hidden above the 110 freeway, 500 yards from the outer reaches of Dodger Stadium's vast parking lots, stand rows of fruit trees growing guavas and avocados, peaches and pomegranates. On this year's summer solstice, a group of volunteers gathered to tend to the obscured orchard atop one of the Figueroa Street tunnels. The event was a collaboration between Farm Party and the Solano Canyon Community Garden, which operates the five-acre space nestled in Elysian Park. It was Farm Party's seventh such event, and the third held here at one of Los Angeles's oldest community gardens. Karina Immer and Guido Lois, two regenerative agricultural professionals, co-founded Farm Party last year with the goal of connecting Angelenos to local gardens and farms. They had their first event on June 28, 2025, at the Solano Canyon Garden. I was one of a couple of dozen volunteers that afternoon who helped build compost bays out of a mound of accumulated garden debris. A year later, the work we did is still visible. The first time, it was like a mountain, said Jamie Pareno, the garden's president. And now it's like, look at it. The Solano Canyon Community Garden is thriving. Last month, the garden celebrated its 30th anniversary and received a sizable grant from City Council member Eunices Hernandez's 1st District office. Pareno said the grant will cover the costs of about a year's worth of water for the garden's 100-plus members, who also pay dues to access plots. The garden hosts weekly volunteers for much of the year, but Pareno said Farm Party events have helped tackle larger tasks and grunt work that require more bodies. It's almost like a barn raiser, Immer said. Many hands make light work. Immer and Lois work with land stewards to find projects to make sense for eager but often inexperienced volunteers. Think weeding or compost turning, not pruning or planting. On the solstice, the first goal was to clear trash that had found its way onto the orchard, then form makeshift berms out of rocks dispersed around the space. We're a vehicle for people who may have never volunteered before or never stepped foot on a farm or garden, Immer said. It's really low stakes, everyone's welcome vibe. What happens after the tasks are finished facilitates that vibe. As the work is winding down, Lois mans a makeshift grill or outdoor oven and prepares dinner, often incorporating produce procured on site. Participants are encouraged, potluck style, to bring a dish, ingredient, or drink that others can enjoy. When people have that endorphin rush of the physical 3-hour volunteer push, having a big feast afterwards feels amazing, Immer said. But also, we think that flavor and food and cooking is a gateway to appreciating the earth. Cooking and eating near the land that we're working on, we hope it provides a little connection in the brain and the soul. In April, at the famed Zorthian Ranch in Altadena, Farm Party hosted its largest event yet. More than 100 volunteers gathered to help restore the longtime artist's haven from damage sustained in the Eaton Fire last year. The Farm Party founders hope to host 6 or 8 entry-level events each year across L.A. Both organizations expect to next host volunteers in August. Follow the Instagram accounts for Farm Party and Solano Canyon Community Garden to learn about the next opportunities. If you're eager to take part in garden work sooner, the Los Angeles Community Garden Council keeps track of various volunteer opportunities at gardens across the city on its website. Other garden bits, California Native Plant Landscaper Certification Cohorts. The Theodore Payne Foundation is offering a number of upcoming courses for students to obtain California Native Plant Landscaper Certification. It is a 20-hour vocational training program over 4 weeks. Most of the program is online, culminating in 1 4-hour in-person practicum. There are cohorts beginning July 7th, July 13th, and August 4th in various locations around Southern California. One course will also be offered in Spanish beginning August 12th in Santa Barbara. That course is free. The other courses range from $350 to $375. For more information, read about the program on the Foundation's website. That is Theodore Payne, one word, .org. Hummingbird exhibit in Ventura. Through August 31st, the Ventura Botanical Gardens is hosting a hummingbird exhibit in partnership with the International Hummingbird Society and more than 20 local artists. Organizers expect visitors will see both Anna's and Alan's hummingbirds on site. Installations include hummingbird head viewing scopes with internal video displays, suspended hummingbird sculptures, a fiber and glass oversized nest, and hummingbird-inspired paintings. Access is included with admission to the gardens, which cost $15 for adults and is free for those age 18 and under. The website is one word, VenturaBotanicalGardens.org. Upcoming events from July 1 through July 15th. On July 1st, the first Wednesday Bird Walk at the White Point Nature Education Center, 9 a.m. in San Pedro. Expert Bob Shanman, an experienced naturalist, will lead a free bird walk for the Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy. Binoculars will be provided, pvplc.org. On July 2nd, rice planting at the Japanese Heritage Shoya House, noon to 2 p.m. in San Marino. The Huntington hosts a rice planting day, offering hands-on learning about Japanese culture and farming techniques with their horticultural curator of Asian gardens. Access is included with a ticket to the Huntington. The website is huntington.org. On July 9th, Cinema Botanica, Little Shop of Horrors, 7 to 10 p.m. in Claremont. The California Botanic Garden will host the next in its series of nature-themed films in its Forest Pavilion. Pre-movie activities include plant puppet making and carnivorous plant trivia. Tickets are $21 general admission, $16 for seniors and students, and $7 for children ages 3 to 12. All paid tickets include free popcorn with optional native plant-infused topping. CALBG.org is the website. On July 10th, Little Explorers, Eco Painting with Nopal and Nature Pigments, 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. Families with young children can create art using natural paints made from plants grown at Descanso Gardens, including Nopal Cactus. Access is included with garden admission. DescansoGardens.org, one word, is the website. On July 11th, farm tours at Apricot Lane Farms, 9 to 11 a.m. in Moore Park. Tour a 234-acre regenerative farm near Los Angeles. It's reported that guests will see a variety of animals, a farm fertility center, a biodiverse orchard, and wildlife ponds with a focus on education. Tickets are $60 plus fees. Kids ages 5 and under are free. Apricot Lane Farms, one word, .com. Also on July 11th, crop swap at Jeff Seymour Family Center, 9 to 11 a.m. in El Monte. Active SGV hosts a monthly crop swap, inviting neighbors to share produce. Bringing in homegrown crops is encouraged but not required to attend the event, and organizers say all attendees will receive free produce. ActiveSGV.org is the website. On July 12th, forest bathing at the Los Angeles County Arboretum and Botanic Garden, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. in Arcadia, inspired by the Japanese tradition of Shinrin Yoku, or forest bathing. You'll engage all your senses as the sun sets. Tickets are $25 for members and $35 for non-members and include garden admission. The website is arboretum.org. And on July 14th, monarchs and milkweeds, an interactive discussion at Sherman Library and Gardens, 7 to 8 p.m. in Corona del Mar. Ron Vanderhoff, president of CalFlora, will speak about the Western monarch and the role Southern California gardeners can play in its survival. Tickets are $10 for members and $20 for non-members. The website is, one word, thesherman.org. What we're reading includes an article in The Times by Grace Toohey's look at what the recent fire wrought on Santa Rosa Island. There is reason to be hopeful about a quick recovery. And Times staff writer Lisa Seidman wrote a personal account of that Santa Rosa fire, looking back at her experiences backpacking the island in 2021. And that's it for the July Plants newsletter, written by Pedro Mora and published on July 1 in the Los Angeles Times. We turn next to the most recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published last Friday, June 26th, in the Financial Times of London. My maxim for the best scented garden? See it, sniff it, source it. From Philadelphus, or mock orange blossom, to Dianthus from the Scent First series, Midsummer never smelled so sweet. The midsummer weekend is a golden one for gardeners. Early June in Britain provided broken cloud, heavy showers, and cool temperatures. They are my garden's dream conditions, so I have been having midsummer dream time of my own. In the evening, as the light fades and the busy world is hushed. Is it midsummer madness, I sometimes wonder, that fine phrase of Shakespeare in his Twelfth Night? It is no such thing. It is a chance for midsummer meditation, a practice I recommend to anyone whose garden is away from the roar of traffic and the rumpus of neighbors. Thankfully, I can give London a midsummer miss. Even more thankfully, I can give London's summer underground a miss too. Nobody is bossing me to see it, say it, sorted. I am pondering threesomes of S, different ones, however, as I look at the garden and a nearby nightingale begins to sing. One is see it, sniff it, source it, the best of maxims when the evening light cools and flowers release intense scent. The winner among scented midsummer shrubs is the Philadelphus, or mock orange blossom. the one which used to be known popularly and incorrectly as syringa. If we could only save one summer shrub, I was recently asked while serving on a charitable panel, which should it be? Philadelphus Belle Étoile is my answer, as it is the sweetest of scented flowering shrubs in June. Belle Étoile was bred in France in 1930 and has been having an exceptionally prolific year in English gardens. The reason is that it responds vigorously to intermittent moisture at its roots. It will grow and flower without it, but this year's showery weather has raised it to a new level. Whenever showers send me back indoors, I have been taking a branch of Belle Étoile inside to fill a vase. It scents an entire room by the following morning. Belle Étoile is the mock orange blossom, which has a distinctive purple stain at the center of its white flowers. It is not as tall as the double-flowered virginal, but even so, it is quite a big shrub, growing about 6 feet high and wide. It will flower next year on the young wood it puts out from now on, so it can be pruned back immediately after flowering. Before long, it becomes too big for most urban gardens. It is a mistake to plant a Belle Étoile in a backyard and then cut it back in a sudden tidy-up during a May bank holiday. Ill-timed cutting is not intelligent pruning. It hacks out wood that is soon to flower and leaves the shrub with a green anticlimax. Since 2023, owners of smaller gardens have new options here. One is to buy Pearls of Perfume, a semi-double white-flowered Philadelphus, which is eminently worthwhile. As it will flower on and on from late May to August, it is a breakthrough in the frame. It grows only 2 feet wide and stops at just under 4 feet in height. It is excellent in a big container, and even there it does not need daily watering. To my critical eye, the short list of contenders to be Plant of the Year at Chelsea contain some unaesthetic horrors. In 2023, Pearls of Perfume was a standout choice, though not judged the official winner. Having seen it, I sniffed it and promptly sourced it. You can do likewise from Thompson & Morgan if you pay £15 for a small plant in a 9-centimeter pot to arrive by late July. It will not flower this year, but will grow quickly and begin to be a pearly wonder for sniffing next summer. In 2024, two other winners arrived, a duo in the Petite Perfume series. They too are smaller than Belle Étoile, let alone virginal, and are covered in masses of small pink or white scented flowers. They were bred after years of crossing and selection by the expert Alan Pustel at Hillier Nursery in Hampshire. In 2025, the pink-flowered Petite Perfume Pink was entered in Chelsea's Plant of the Year contest. Its color of pale pink with a darker center was a novelty in the family of Philadelphus, and this time the right plant won. Like Pearls of Perfume, this prize winner will flower from late May for several weeks. It is very good in a container. Petite Perfume White exists too, another Philadelphus which flowers with wonderful freedom. It is very difficult to kill, and eventually will reach 4 to 5 feet, slightly higher than Pearls of Perfume. If you want a big plant, try sourcing one from Thompson & Morgan, too, who quote £28 for a plant in a 3-liter pot. Smaller plants in 9-centimeter pot are much cheaper. My next maxim is see it, snip it, strike it. Not hitting a plant, but striking a bit of it as a cutting in well-drained soil. Top candidates here for midsummer action are the best long-flowering varieties of dianthus, or pink, which are just passing their first peak in the season. The best ones are those bred recently by Whitman Pinks in Dawlish, Devon, whose Scent First series is indeed a breakthrough. If you are still enthusing over briefly flowering Mrs. Simpkins, you are missing out on months of prolonged color. In the Scent First series, that's S-C-E-N-T, dark red double-flowered Passion and White Memories are outstandingly good, with names to resonate with open-hearted gardeners and their love life. Others have just been added to the range, all of which are hardy in winter if they are planted in very gritty soil. I find they look bedraggled after months of winter rain, but will recover nonetheless if grit makes up at least half of their soil mix. I never tire of recommending them, especially as cuttings can be taken in the next fortnight and rooted easily after a few weeks in pots of gritty open compost. Whitman is still offering Passion in 9-centimeter pots for £5 each plus delivery. Say it with dianthus, not diamonds. But please note, memories are currently out of stock. There I sit, letting darkness fall and subordinating my mind to a view which I have entirely planted myself. Intruders then intervene, rabbits without a visa, and slugs among the French marigolds. See it, slime, and strip it is the latter midsummer motto, but see it, shoot it, squash it flashes into my peace-loving mind. I bet you do not have an eco-solution which works for hungry wild rabbits. As for folk wisdom about slugs, in a garden of 2 acres, I cannot mess around. Hollow out grapefruits cut in half and fill them with beer to drown the intruders. I would need crates of grapefruits to protect even 2 of the many borders. Slug pellets are my answer. Solid metal ones are my fantasy for rabbits, and organic pellets in bottles from Bayer to kill off sliming snails. In gardens, too, spending on defense is essential. The most recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published on June 26th in the Financial Times of London, my maxim for the best scented garden, see it, sniff it, source it. We turn next to a column by Margaret Roach, published on June 30th in the New York Times. Margaret Roach is the creator of the website and podcast A Way to Garden and a book of the same name. Her column, Why It's Best Not to Rush a Relationship, is part of their In the Garden series. The designer Dan Pearson says, intentionally creating landscapes slowly can produce the most inspiring results, as well as opportunities for fine-tuning later. The celebrated English landscape designer Dan Pearson really knows how to read the room, the outdoor room, drawing on an uncanny instinct for divining what goes where and a depth of patience many of us gardeners might well be wise to cultivate. He was already a leader in the naturalistic movement with an impressive global portfolio of projects when he came to Hillside, the place he now calls home in Somerset, England. Before making his first design move there, though, he nevertheless allowed himself 6 years to start a dialogue, quote-unquote, with the place. His words, in a key to his process. A more practical timeline, 1 year, is what he typically suggests to clients. You need to grow a garden, don't you? He said. And even just the ideas. You need to grow those ideas. So there's much to be said, I think, for taking the time to understand something. Mr. Pearson's landscapes are immersive, existing in a magical borderline between control and abandon, what he calls the teetering point between a maintained space and one where nature holds sway. He draws on intuition and hands-on practice honed since childhood, when he helped his parents uncover the arts and crafts home they'd bought that was positively engulfed by the wildness of a long-neglected garden. For gardeners experimenting with pivoting to a looser landscaping style, that delicious teetering point may prove an elusive destination. Where does he take his cues from that gradually alert him to what it can become? He shared some of his thinking. Hey, not so fast. Mr. Pearson never hurries toward design decisions. At Hillside, which is also the backdrop of the online magazine Dig Delve that he and his partner, Hugh Morgan, publish, he had the luxury of indulging in those 6 years of getting acquainted with the land to look and plan my first move, he said. He didn't undertake any garden making on the 20-acre former farm before that, beyond growing vegetables and trialing some plants, the start of his knowledge gathering about the soil and climate, and reseeding old pasture. By the time he started 10 years ago on what are now 1.5 acres of gardens that intimately anchored the house and other buildings, all but a handful of the 50 options I had when I had first looked at the site had fallen away, he said. Only those really worth pursuing stuck. Even a year offers a chance to observe and listen to each lesson, he said. Is there a wind we need to shelter from in March? Where does the light reach in the darkest month? Where do you need shade in the hottest month? Is there something that happens on the site that's a magical moment that you want to be part of or have more of? And then you build from that. Important. Make notes of your first impressions, but resist analyzing. It's like meeting a new person and getting a feeling from that person, but not judging, he said. That observational research, as he describes it, is the foundation of everything to come. A design at the woodland edge. It's no coincidence that Mr. Pearson uses term like informal and led by asymmetry rather than symmetry and layered to describe his naturalistic compositions, for those are among nature's foundational design principles and key concepts to keep in mind. Go stand at the edge of the woods, he said, and look at how the adjacent habitats coexist. You will not see symmetry, but lots of layers. You've got the trees, which form the shade, he said, and then the layering of sub-shrubs or shrubs underneath the trees, which are more kind of human scale. And then you've got the perennials, which come and go throughout the course of that relatively short season underneath the shade. The layering continues out into the sunnier areas, enacted by a different cast of plants. Even in a relatively narrow palette, they're all working together, each performing in its time before the next one takes a turn, creating a succession through the seasons. They're all interdependent, Mr. Pearson said, and the layering allows you to have miniature ecologies. It allows you to have moments where things are happening and then they can dim. It allows you to have continuity, ephemerality. Is there a view or the suggestion of one? Views, whether borrowed or created, enlarge the experience of a landscape. And Mr. Pearson's home at Hillside, as its name hints, is long on them. Robin Hill, a residential project in Norfolk, Connecticut, for instance, initially felt claustrophobic to him, walled in by trees. I knew we were on top of a hill, more or less, but you just couldn't see out, he said. Creating long views was impractical, but editing to make some clearings that let the light fall to the forest floor, he said, meant it felt magical and sparkling. So you then had a mood that changed by simply removing 2 or 3 trees. Let your intention show and make some rules. Although his work is always underpinned by informality, Mr. Pearson said, there is always also an aspect of formality figured in that contrasts it, because you've got to keep tension. At Hillside, the solidity of a brick path and a stretch of stone wall provide defining contrast for airy, effusive plantings in the area called the sand garden. Among the simplest examples, what happens when you just mow a path through a meadow? It's like the piping on a garment that makes the garment special rather than too plain, he said. It's something that just allows you to see that actually you have had some input. Pathway edges might lose their sharpness if self-sown seedlings or certain perennials expanding summertime circumference are left to have their way. Knowing your tolerance for such effusiveness from none, clean edges only, thank you, to an openness to wandering a fuzzy path where volunteers caress your legs is essential. Establishing a protocol that delivers your vision is equally so. Mr. Pearson specified some paths at Hillside to be 2 meters, or about 6 feet wide, for instance, to accommodate key plants' fullest moments without allowing the walkway they flank to feel closed in. What each of us needs, he said, is to know that you've got a set of rules you can apply, your own rules that might say, I'm going to cut that down once a year, every year, and you need to find the right time to do it, but it just might make all the difference. Keep your conversation with the place going. The gardener's learning curve is never completed any more than the garden is. The ongoing silent conversation with a space signals what interventions to contemplate as you both evolve. You learn to do those things in a garden as you garden a place, Mr. Pearson said. And then there are other things that are like keeping the terraces swept, just very simple stuff that allows it to feel intentional. And one more thing, however small or large any effort under consideration may seem, it's always best approached from a place of humility, Mr. Pearson said. Just as at the beginning of the relationship, don't rush. You have to just keep on stepping back, he said, and saying, do we need that? How can we do it more lightly? Is it the right thing? In a sidebar, stone found on the site at Robin Hill in Connecticut was fashioned into a dramatic cairn that commands attention and provides an unexpected destination on woodland walks. An article by Margaret Roach, published in the New York Times on June 30th, Why It's Best Not to Rush a Relationship. We close this week with an article by Claire Colson, published on the 1st of July, as part of the HTSI Garden section. We're still silly for the lily pad. Monet's favorite subject has found a new fashionability. Why? In the Prince of Wales Conservatory at Kew Gardens, the world's largest water lily, Victoria boliviana, unfurls around midsummer. At first, it looks like a green hedgehog, says former Kew horticulturalist Bree Langley. Then, over the course of 2 weeks, it slowly reveals itself. The floating pads, which can grow up to 3 meters wide, are deeply ribbed like crocodile skin and edged in spikes. They're designed like battering rams to push their way past any other vegetation on the pond and take over as much space as possible, says Langley. In ancient times, water lilies were symbols of rebirth, purity, or enlightenment. The Latin name Nymphaea is linked with the nymphs of Greek and Roman mythology. From the 1890s to the 1920s, Claude Monet produced more than 200 canvases of his lily-strewn pond, paintings that will be the focus of Monet Painting Time at the Musée de l'Orangerie in Paris in September. When Jonathan Anderson presented Dior's AW26 women's wear collection in the Jardin des Tuileries, the bassin octogonal was dotted with glossy, though artificial, water lilies. The motifs then made their way onto dresses, accessories, and shoes. The aquatic plants can, which flower outside in the UK from June to September, the more floriferous, and tender tropical versions are often fragrant, and in some cases, night-blooming. These include the bright fuchsia Mayploy and the ethereal white star-shaped Juno. The dinner plate-sized flowers of Victoria cruziana expel a pineapple scent to attract its pollinator, a nocturnal beetle that is held captive inside for 24 hours. In 19th century England, the monster South American plants caused a sensation, stealing the show at Kew's Water Lily House when it opened in 1852. When the glass house reopens after refurbishment next spring, visitors will be met with a wall of scent and color, says Langley. It really hits every sense. Smaller tropical varieties include Kew's Kabuki, bearing light blue flowers with bright red stamens, and Kew's Stowaway Blues, its bulbous blooms of vivid purple-blue. It was hybridizer Joseph Bory Latour-Marviac who popularized the plant in Europe. At his nursery in Le Temple-sur-l'Eau in southwest France, he created 19 new varieties between 1870 and 1880. His hardy hybrids were exhibited at the 1889 World's Fair in Paris. One of the visitors was Monet. After buying a parcel of land adjoining his house in the French village of Giverny, the artist set about creating a pond. Inspired by Japanese gardens, he planted irises and wisteria. He installed a bridge and in 1894 placed his first order with Latour Marliac. I got a catalog and simply chose at random, Monet once said. many of the Latul Maliok introductions are still available and are represented in the National Water Lily Collection, now cared for by Carl Welsh at 15th century Hurst Monceau Castle in East Sussex and Bennett's Water Gardens near Weymouth in Dorset. The latter is a living library of 300 varieties. One of third-generation plantsman James Bennett's favorites is the dwarf lily Perry's Baby Red, with glossy red petals. It's very free-flowering and doesn't take over, so it's suitable for a container garden, he says. For all their prettiness, they also serve a practical purpose. The pads keep pond water healthy by restricting light and suppressing algae. In the past 20 years, new hybrids have been created with colorful or two-tone leaves, such as lemon meringue, featuring soft yellow, full double flowers, and purple speckled pads. For connoisseurs, the scent is also key. Langley singles out Albert Greenberg with peachy pink flowers that smell sherbety, and St. Louis Gold, a beautiful lemon-colored bloom with a citrus scent. Some cultivars of Nymphaea carpentariae are reminiscent of Parma violets. I always make sure my students take the time to smell them when they are up close to them, says Langley. The scent doesn't carry very far, but this seems to add to their allure. Not only are the flowers mysterious, beautiful, and strange, but there's also this sense of, this is just for me. An article by Claire Colson, published on the 1st of July in the Financial Times of London, We're Still Silly for the Lily Pad. The article also features items affiliated with lilies, Bordallo Pinero's leaf dish with frog at £27, Klaus Porto Madrigal water lily soap at £18, Chive ceramic ivory European water lily at £61.08, and Perfumer H water lily EDP priced £710 for 100 milliliters. John Darien Decoupage water lilies tray is £340. Common American swan matches, price at £9. That wraps up edition 350 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for and produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house, or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Have a happy and safe 4th of July weekend. And until the next time.